10 years from the start of the genocide in the Sudanese region of Darfur, a book is being launched that chronicles the author's struggle to bring the humanitarian catastrophe to the attention of global leaders. Entitled Against a Tide of Evil, the book is by Mukesh Kapila, former UN chief for Sudan and professor of global humanitarian affairs at Manchester University. Professor Kapila told me that the book focuses particularly on his traumatic year as UN coordinator in Sudan, where he arrived in 2003, hopefully to oversee peace building after a long internal war there, but found himself grappling with the suffering in Darfur. It also raises the alarm that ethnic cleansing continues to be perpetrated in other Sudanese regions, where hundreds of thousands of people, bombed out of their villages and farms, have been cut off from international humanitarian relief since the outbreak of hostilities between the Sudanese government and opposition groups in June 2011. I speak to you as you prepare to launch your book entitled Against a Tide of Evil, which actually chronicles your battle to get the world to start taking notice of what was going on in Sudan when you were a UN Sudan chief there. Can you tell me a little bit about the book itself?
So the book is basically my life experience. It focuses particularly on my traumatic year as UN coordinator in Sudan, where I arrived in 2003, hopefully to oversee peace building after a long internal war there, but found myself grappling with Darfur. But it also touches upon my experiences witnessing the genocide in Rwanda 10 years previously, as well as my experiences in Srebrenica and other situations around the world, such as Sierra Leone, Afghanistan, and the such like. So it's really, the focus is on my efforts to grapple against the crimes against humanity in Darfur, but the journey begins in locations in many, many other places.
You call it a traumatic year, and you say that you knew from day one what was going on, but no one was taking any notice at all. Can you tell me a little bit about what you did to raise awareness and who you turned to and what happened?
Yes. Well, when I got to Sudan in April 2003, 10 years exactly this month, the evidence soon became clear that what was going on in Darfur was an orchestrated ethnic cleansing attempt masterminded by the government of al-Bashir in Khartoum, targeted against tribes of black African ethnic origin, and it met all the criteria of ethnic cleansing. In other words, the violence was directed at doing away with a group of people and their way of life on a permanent basis, exterminating them. And to me, this echoed my own experiences in Rwanda, Srebrenica, and elsewhere. When I brought that evidence to the attention of world leaders, such as Kofi Annan, who was Secretary General of the United Nations at the time, and other senior leaders in the United Nations system, as well as members of the Security Council, countries like the British government, who I was still on secondment from to the UN, as well as the French authorities, the Americans, and so on, it soon became clear that this was an inconvenient bit of information at that moment in time, because the world was grappling with Iraq, Saddam, and many other issues. And also, there was a peace process going on between Khartoum and Juba at that moment, which it was felt that the suffering of Darfur and the violence in Darfur would distract the accomplishment of that peace process. So basically, I was told, we will come round to Darfur when we are ready, but meanwhile, we've got other and more important things to do.
So you turned to the media, right? Because we did hear about Darfur.
Yes, in the end, it was quite clear that there was a lot of concern. But because world governments, particularly Security Council, were unwilling or unable to act, I was left with no choice but to actually go beyond them to speak to the world's peoples. And this is what I did through the media. And when that happened, the story became well-known almost overnight, and the Security Council in particular was forced to act.
I remember George Clooney, for example, being a testimonial for the cause.
Yes. Well, as soon as people became aware that there was a place called Darfur, that what was going on there was terrible atrocities, and that this was the first genocide of the millennium, as it now turns out to be, then a lot of activists, civil society, and celebrities got into the act. However, unfortunately, it was somewhat too little, somewhat too late, because, of course, by then, the ethnic cleansing was complete. So even though after Rwanda we had sworn never again, not on our patch and such like. We were presiding over, in a sense, the first genocide of the century.
Professor Kapila, I have watched your video clip in which you present your book, and in it you say that those who did nothing to stop the genocide are in fact as guilty as those who wielded the knife or shot the guns.
This is an extremely important message from the book. Obviously, the primary responsibility for the crimes against humanity rests on the leaders who dreamed up these genocidal ideologies and then perpetrated them through an organized effort of government and those under their control. However, we live in the global media age, and the tragedy is that even as the atrocities were unfolding in Darfur, we were able to document and gather information that was not available, for example, at the time of the Rwanda genocide 10 years previous to that, you see. So the fact that we did not know what was going on cannot be held as an alibi for inaction. And I strongly believe that those who stood by and did nothing are almost as equally culpable as those who actually pulled the trigger or, stabbed the victims. And of course, the greater the position you occupy, the higher the responsibility. And unless accountability of those who stood by and do nothing is properly acknowledged, at least in historical terms, clearly the chapter cannot be closed. And the book is all about accountability at all levels. And if we don't have accountability, then these kinds of atrocities will continue to occur and reoccur and reoccur.
Unfortunately, I read that they are reoccurring. You yourself travelled to Sudan again this year, and you went to Blue Nile State and Nuba Mountains. Would you like to tell us what is happening there?
Yes. In January this year, I decided to return to the region that I had left 10 years previously. I went cross-border into the Nuba Mountains, into the Blue Nile, and very close to the border in Darfur. And I was appalled to see that the violence of Darfur that I personally witnessed 10 years ago is not just being replicated in the other regions, Blue Nile and Nuba Mountains, but that in the intervening 10 years, the technology of warfare has become more sophisticated. So the government of Sudan, which has become richer in the interim, thanks to the oil, thanks to trade, and thanks to development in general terms, has armed itself with modern missiles, modern fighter aircraft, anti-personnel landmines, cluster bombs, many of them actually manufactured in the country thanks to its trading partners. And therefore, the violence that I witnessed in January was, if anything, worse than what I saw in Darfur 10 years ago. So we have not just the impunity that has attended the perpetration of these crimes 10 years ago and the perpetrators are being allowed to get away with it, it's emboldened them to repeat what they're doing with even greater efficiency in the other regions I mentioned.
This situation raises a series of very serious issues, and not least the fact that Bashir, who is in fact wanted by the ICC, is still head of state. How is this possible in your view?
Well, the good thing is that at least when the world did wake up, too late perhaps, it was outraged, and the inquiries that took place and the referral to the International Criminal Court led to the indictment of the president for crimes against humanity, as well as other people around him. Now, that was, in justice terms, an advance. But obviously, apprehending a serving head of state in a powerful country is no mean feat, and I'm not advocating that people should march and arrest him. This is clearly not practical. However, economic sanctions, diplomatic sanctions, trade sanctions, reducing the means by which he might wage war on his own citizens and turning up the pressure on him can help a lot in terms of ensuring that we do have change, political change in Sudan, so that the country can return to the path of peace and justice. So while these things are going on, resistance is mounting, and it is only a matter of time before the regime goes. My concern is that along the way, there is still more suffering to come, and we must make sure that we stay in solidarity with the long-suffering people of the Nuba Mountains, the Blue Nile, Darfur, and other parts of Sudan before this phase of history is done.
Now, in fact, your book is a wake-up call, isn't it? It's an incitement to everyone who reads it and who takes, on this awareness to take some kind of action. Is there anything we can do as individuals, as readers?
Well, as someone has said, it is only necessary for evil to flourish, for good men to do nothing. So the book is about pointing out to ordinary citizens, people all over the world, that they have a personal responsibility to take an interest in what is done in their names by their governments, both acts of omission as well as acts of commission. Governments who stand by and do nothing, as well as, of course, evil-minded governments who perpetrate these kinds of atrocities in theaters around the world. And it is for citizens to come together. And today we live in a globalized world, interconnected by media as well as ideas. And never before have there been so many opportunities for influencing and promoting a positive change and ensuring justice takes place and that the human wrongs are righted. And so it is a call for all citizens, for people like you and me and anyone else, that they're not entirely powerless as it sounds, that they can call to account their leaders, their governments, who act or don't act in their particular names. And I think by doing that, I hope the world will become a better and more just place.
Notwithstanding, shall we say, the traumatic events that gave life to your memoir, yours is a message of hope.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I think it would be completely pointless to end a book or to write a book which is hopeless and pessimistic. The point is that though the genocide in Darfur has been called the most successful genocide because it's still going on 10 years later, even the Holocaust did not last that long. Even Rwanda only lasted 100 days, though millions, of course, were killed in both places. The reason it's carrying on is that people are resisting. And as long as there is resistance, as long as people stand up for their dignity, their human rights, then these kinds of evil plots will not succeed. And that's the hopeful and inspirational message for all of us, to stand shoulder to shoulder against this tide of evil. And in the end, these things will pass. But along the way, we have to stick closely to our principles and not let down the people who are at the front line confronting impunity, injustice, and evil violence of the sort that the book describes.
Oh, I will definitely read your book. Can we get it in bookshops in the near future?
Yes, it's available. It can be ordered from Amazon.co.uk or through your local bookshops who can order it. Digital versions are also available. And the North American edition will be released in a week or so as well.
Thank you so much, Professor Kapila. Is there anything else you'd like to say?
I would say that it's important that these are not just blips from time to time, that radios like yours and messages that you send out and the people who listen to you need to keep abreast. This is a somewhat longer haul than we would like. It takes time to overcome these issues. And it's important that, therefore, we don't forget them and then suddenly woken up again with surprise when the same thing is repeated somewhere else. It is necessary to show steady solidarity in the cause of justice and for righting human wrongs. And this means steady day-to-day effort, helping local communities, building up the capabilities of those who are at the front line. And because in the end, it is the people of Sudan themselves who have to lead change for themselves. In the end, it is for Sudanese to determine their own destiny, their own future. But it's important that the rest of the world is in solidarity. And at least in relations with Sudan, we don't do any harm.
And it's important to remember as well, isn't it?
Yeah. That's right, absolutely. It's very, very important to remember. It's very, very important to remember the historical lessons from all these similar situations, whether it is Cambodia, whether it is Rwanda, whether it is Bosnia, and, of course, the great atrocities of Latin America in the 1970s and 80s. Because if you don't learn from history, we are doomed to repeat it. And I think as a final word, I would also say is that when a crime against humanity takes place in one place, it is a crime against all humanity everywhere. That is why this is not a matter of just African problem or Asian problem or European problem. When such mass atrocities and crimes against humanity are committed, it should unite us as a humanity. It is only when we get together that can confront these things. These sorts of things happen in all continents, in all ages, and there is no moral superiority of any one culture against another. And that's why it's important to rally around as a world whenever these kinds of things happen in any corner.